Our first case for argument is Simic v. City of Chicago. Mr. Yucharevich.
Good morning, Justice. May it please the Court. Thank you for this opportunity as well to appear before the Court and argue. This case stems from the City of Chicago's ordinance regulating motor vehicles and the use of electronic devices while operating those motor vehicles. Specifically, the City of Chicago earlier passed a law stating that the violation of the ordinance requiring individuals to use hands-free devices or otherwise the violation of the ordinance that forbids using your cell phone while operating a motor vehicle set the fine at $100 to $500. Subsequent to that, the state of Illinois passed their own statewide law as to operating a motor vehicle while using a cell phone device. Their fines were staggered and set from $75 to $100 to $125 to $150 for every violation thereafter. Plaintiff was cited under the city ordinance and sent to have it enforced in the administrative court. Plaintiff was cited for a $500, or there was a default judgment entered against plaintiff for $500. Plaintiff then filed suit claiming that the city ordinance violates the Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment due process clause. The reason being is that Illinois law prohibits cities, including home rule municipalities, from passing traffic regulations which are inconsistent with the uniform state traffic regulations.
Sounds like a state law issue.
Well, it sounds like a state law issue, but it really isn't just a state law issue. Furthermore, they were not allowed to pass the Chicago, the ordinance was not allowed to be passed and enforced in administrative court. And that's where the procedural due process and the Eighth Amendment claims come in. You see, the Fifth Circuit, I believe, has held that if a fine exceeds the statutory limits, it violates the excessive fines clause set by the General Assembly or...
Counsel, let me ask you a more fundamental question about
yes.
subject matter jurisdiction. The plaintiff has not paid this judgment, has she?
Correct.
There's a judgment against her in the state courts. We would ordinarily say that someone who has an objection to that, whether based on federal or state law, is required to pursue an appeal within the state courts, as she's allowed to do in this case, correct? This is the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine.
No. And the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine has exceptions. However, the key...
Explain.
Well,
In essence, I don't understand why either your client doesn't have standing because she hasn't been injured, or Rooker-Feldman wouldn't bar this case.
Well, the problem is that initially there was a default judgment entered against her. The case law and the jurisprudence says that you don't have to go through all the state channels to assert a federal rights claim based on administrative action or conduct occurring at a state level.
You don't have to exhaust state remedies.
Right.
But when you are being sued in state court or prosecuted in state court, you generally have to assert your federal defenses there. And if you are injured by a state court judgment, you have to appeal within the state courts. You can't go to the federal courts because of Rooker-Feldman.
Right, but Rooker-Feldman sometimes has an exception when the government is acting or the state government is acting or enforcing a law that's patently against the United States Constitution or patently against due process, where it's flagrantly just violative of the Constitution. And even though the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine exists, the federal courts still have a duty to make sure that there isn't a manifest injustice. And I think the duty of equity and the equitable powers of the court make sure that they have to have a just result despite those types of issues.
And but, since your client has not been harmed, what would that just result be here?
Well, the issue of harm, my client was harmed. She was subject to proceedings that were arbitrary and violative. There was a judgment assessed. Now,
yeah, but here's the problem. You
yes.
want injunctive relief. She can't show an actual or imminent threat of injury. The only way she gets injured again is if she uses her cell phone while driving, is stopped while she's using it, and then cited under the Chicago ordinance instead of Illinois law. All those things have to happen, right?
Well, No, not necessarily, because there's a difference between that fact pattern and ours. In our fact pattern, the judgment was entered, suit was filed in federal court, and then the city later dismissed, voluntarily stopped the actions that were complained about. And under the United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, when the defendant voluntarily ceases the action that was complained of, it now becomes their burden to show that this would never happen again, or that there is no standing, because that would allow the defendant, basically anytime someone brought a suit, the defendant could dismiss the lawsuit that was illegal, or cease the conduct that was illegal,
yeah,
and then it escapes review.
What the plaintiff has to show is a likelihood she'll be prosecuted again. That's what the Supreme Court said in Lyons and O'Shea, what we said in Sierakowski and Robinson. In order to get this injunction, the plaintiff has to show that.
Well, Your Honor,
be prosecuted again.
I agree. The plaintiff has to show that, but in this case, during the pendency of the case, the matter was dismissed
So should we order the district judge to enjoin the case that's no longer going forward?
Well, the case is still going forward.
How is it?
We have a civil rights claim for nominal damages. It survives anything. The claim that her rights were violated. I mean, what the city did was, in essence, pass a law, collect fines that they weren't allowed to, in violation of the Eighth Amendment. Surely a fine that's not allowed to be collected, or a fine that is not legally allowed, is excessive under the Eighth Amendment. It's arbitrary and excessive.
That's a great way to turn every state court citation into a federal civil rights claim.
Well,
right? If you have a disagreement about whether the fine is authorized under state law, in all areas of law, we have consistently said the fact that a state or a local government may violate state law in some way does not establish a federal civil rights violation or denial of due process.
Correct. But the 14th Amendment, its fundamentals don't come from an idea of state law. It comes from a deeply rooted sense of what you would say fairness and justice. And so it doesn't depend on state law. And that's what we're bringing here. I mean,
it does depend on state law. Because it's only because of your home rule type argument, which, frankly, I have very serious doubts about, but only because of that you can argue that this is excessive, because it supposedly violates state law. That turns violations of state law into violations of the federal Constitution and gets us into policing Illinois state law issues.
I agree, Your Honor, and part of it is that in some circumstances that is correct, but in other circumstances where the government acts arbitrarily, that's what due process protects an individual from.
How do we tell the difference?
The difference will be told on a case-by-case basis, and
come
I think
on. You've got to give us some help. The theory you're using. Unless there are some limits to it, and if you can deal with the issue of mootness, would open up the federal courts to a wide array of state law issues, and you can't just say based on our intuitive sense of fairness on a case-by-case basis.
Well, it's not so much. I think it's what is the nature of the violation being complained of. You see, the Illinois State Constitution has no Eighth Amendment. They have a proportionate penalties clause, which is different. It doesn't protect somebody from excessive fines expressly. So the only recourse that an individual would have would be the Eighth Amendment via the 14th Amendment to come to the federal courts. And that's our assertion here, because we don't have a state court claim for violation of excessive fines. There is no excessive fines clause. There's only an excessive fines clause under the Eighth Amendment. So in this case, we're asserting something that is predominantly a constitutional claim, not a state law issue. We're saying that the state went beyond the scope of its powers, which is just like a Fourth Amendment issue. If the state was to pass a Fourth Amendment law that violates the Fourth Amendment on its face, we're saying that the state government, has gone beyond the confines of the United States Constitution.
How?
By assessing fines that they're legally not allowed to, and by
not legally allowed to by state law.
Correct, by state law.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
But again, there is no other procedural vehicle to protect the individual. And so the Eighth Amendment has to protect the individual, whether they assess it, however which way they assess the fines. The test for excessiveness can be used on a state fine, on a local ordinance, or on a federal fine. And that's what we brought here, was a claim that the Eighth Amendment is being violated because they are arbitrarily assessing a fine.
Well, even if you get over the injunction hurdle, which I don't think you get over, she has an adequate remedy at law. I don't understand why an injunction needs to be issued. Why can't she just wait until the case proceeds?
Well, the case was the
federal case.
Well, at the time she filed the injunction, there was a live judgment against her. Right. Subsequent to that, there was a delay in the proceedings roughly 6 months. And the city stopped their conduct. Once the city voluntarily stops their conduct, it's their burden to show that this is not moot.
No, my question is, what harm will she suffer if she has to wait for any relief until this case is decided on the merits in federal court?
She's already suffered the harm. That's the problem. It's already irreparable harm.
Which is, what is it?
She was denied
she didn't
her right.
The fine.
Right, but she had to go to court. She was forced to retain counsel. She was forced to go to 400 Superior.
She retained counsel for a cell phone citation?
Yes, Your Honor. For $100 to $500 fines, she retained counsel. But nonetheless, how petty, how big it is, an individual is entitled to the constitutional right to counsel. And it's not for us to decide whether an individual's choice in that was not the best choice. But I think that...
So every time there's an unjustified parking ticket or traffic ticket, and you hire counsel, you can come to federal court and get relief?
No, that would be opening the floodgates, right? But that's why there's standards set to determine that on a preliminary motion to dismiss a 12B6, you can say if a guy got a $10 parking ticket and came here before the court and filed it, surely no lawyer would in good faith even file that. But here it's not a $10 parking ticket. Here it's a violation of state law. It's inconsistent traffic regulations. It has an effect on interstate commerce because people are traveling through it. But the most important part, it's a blatant disregard of the Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment.
Thank you.
Ms. Dimitrova?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. To begin with, I would like to address some of the procedural questions raised by Judge Hamilton. What happened with the underlying administrative state proceeding is that eventually there is no judgment, state judgment to enforce because the city non-suited. It's administrative prosecution of Ms. Simic, and we attach the evidence of non-suit in our appendix at A5. So the default judgment on the motion of the plaintiff's counsel was vacated.
Why did the city non-suit?
It's not in the record, and just out of my knowledge, it actually has no correlation with, it's no connection to the federal district court suit because the two branches of city government were not actually communicating with each other, so the lawyers who were prosecuting the federal district case actually didn't know what was going on in the city proceeding, so it has no connection to the federal prosecution.
One can imagine harassing a person by bringing suits, charges, what have you, and then abandoning them. So you put the person to the expense of litigation, and then you prevent the person from obtaining any remedy.
Well, Your Honor, at this particular juncture, the only issue on appeal is the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction, and the court's inquiry is limited to the propriety of the injunctive relief.
Yeah, but how do we know, because I agree with Judge Perlman, how do we know the city won't just non-suit an administrative claim against any plaintiff who challenges the ordinance's constitutionality?
Well, I guess we do not know that. I mean it's a matter of discretion it's a matter of discretion, of prosecutorial, I guess, discretion in the administrative proceedings. And the, to my knowledge, you know, as we're attaching our appendix, the matter was continued several times with agreement of the plaintiff's counsel.
Well, do we know, how do we know whether this is a practice of the city? I mean, maybe the city feels that its authority to for this ordinance is dubious, and but it figures, well, it'll bring charges. Probably most of the people will pay rather than hire a lawyer. And if they do hire a lawyer, we'll just drop the thing. Right?
Well, the lawyer was hired back in January of 2015, I believe. And so the city kept prosecuting its administrative case for 6 months. So if that was actually the practice, if the city was waiting, if the people would pay or they would hire counsel, you know, I would assume they would have non-suited the case much sooner than 6 months. I mean, as a matter of fact, of this particular plaintiff, she always maintained that she's bankrupt and she cannot pay the fine, she has no financial resources. And at a certain point, I believe city, you know, has to invest, you know, resources, the limited city resources to actually prosecute its cases. It's a very low fine. As a matter of course, when the people show up for the administrative hearing, which Ms. Simic didn't do, I mean, the fine is not set at $500. I mean, that's a default fine. The fines are actually set at about $100. So, I mean, is it really worth for the city to show up six times and having met a continued, you know, for a $100 fine where the person is saying that she's bankrupt and she cannot pay it? I mean, there is a cost-benefit analysis in the
I'm
city
sorry,
going on as well.
I don't understand what point you're making.
Well, you know, your Honor suggested that there is some malevolent motive behind the city,
right,
not non-suiting it. I'm trying
well,
to
it's
explain.
Very strange to bring charges, then dismiss them as soon as the person hires a lawyer.
And my answer to your Honor is that
and
it
why
was
do
not
they
as
do that? Why do they do that?
It's not in the record in this particular case. I do not know.
Isn't that an important question?
I believe not, because
the city is systematically harassing people, knowing that most of them are not going to.
I believe it's not, Your Honor, because with all due respect, it's not factually accurate. Your suggestion is not factually accurate.
The what city, isn't accurate?
The suggestion that the city non-suited its case
well,
as soon
you,
as the
what's
council
the evidence
was hired.
That, what's the evidence that I'm...
Well, the evidence
accurate.
Is in our appendix. You know, we could look at the procedural posture of the administrative state proceeding. We could look at all the, you know, continuances for 6 months until the city non-suited the case. So the plaintiff retained counsel back in January, and it notified the administrative agency and the city in January. There were several, four or five continuances until May. And only in May the city non-suited its case.
And those,
I do not know
those
why.
Continuances during those 6 months, those were at the request of the plaintiff?
I believe it was with agreement. I'm not sure if it was at the request of the plaintiff. But at this point, I do not know. It's beyond the record in this case. And I do not. I strongly believe it is not critical on the preliminary injunction posture of this case, because plaintiff does not have standing to assert equitable injunctive relief, to seek equitable injunctive relief. She cannot demonstrate real and imminent threat of being subjected to a future injury. She doesn't even allege that she intends in the future to engage in the illegal conduct of texting while driving. And her claim of any future injury would be based on a series of conjectures that she would actually engage in this illegal conduct, that she would be stopped by police would notice, that she would be issued a notice of a violation, and that either administrative law judge or the circuit court judge would impose a fine on her in excess of what the state law allows. And so this is the type of a very speculative claim to future injury that can never support a stand-in for prospective injunctive relief. And with respect to constitutional underlying constitutional claims, we believe there is no likelihood of success on the merits here. We would stand on our briefs, but you know, I agree with the comments made by the panel that all of Ms. Simic's claims are based on the fundamentally flawed notion that a violation of state law, even if there were a violation, constitutes a federal constitutional violation. State law is never a benchmark of what is constitutional under federal law. And if we apply the accurate federal constitutional standards, your claim would fail. And also what ties into the lack of standing is that the lack of irreparable harm. Ms. Simic never had to pay a fine. She will never have to pay a fine. And to the extent that she herself personally does not have standing, to assert a claim
what
for
prospect- if the city's, what if the city's ordinance had absolutely no basis in Illinois law?
It would still be just a matter of state law that does not by itself establish a federal constitutional violation.
I don't understand why. The city passes an ordinance for which there is no legal authority whatsoever and enforces it. Wouldn't that be a taking of property without due process of law? Take people's property. If a public official, a public office, takes people's property with no legal basis whatsoever, why isn't that a deprivation of property without due process of law?
In this particular case, though, certainly, for instance, the district court noted in its decision that the city of Chicago absolutely does have home rule authority.
Well, I'm just asking a hypothetical question, right?
That is completely detached.
Suppose the mayor announces that he's going to charge people who don't comb their hair, and wouldn't you say that would raise constitutional issues? No authority to do that.
Well, it would require deprivation of a fundamental liberty interest or property interest. So in that instance, maybe. In this particular instance, there is no deprivation of a property
well,
interest.
Well, so what about this? If the city doesn't have any authority to impose this sanction, why isn't that violation of the Fifth Amendment?
But it is not this case. In this case, there is no deprivation of a property interest, there is no deprivation of liberty interest, and there is no standing to assert this claim. So your question could be probably better answered in a more appropriate case.
I don't understand. She had to, or she felt she had to, pay a lawyer. So that would be a deprivation of property without due process if there is no legal basis for this ordinance.
Well, as a matter of fact, the council is retained on a contingency basis, so she actually didn't pay it. But there is no standing to assert prospective equitable relief, and it's the only issue before this court. I mean, we're not even addressing the merits of your constitutional claims, like per se. The case, if Ms. Simic prevails, in any event, in the case, whatever this court does on the injunction, the case will go back to the district court, and the district court will have a chance to address these issues.
What? So why should we not just dismiss for lack of standing and subject matter jurisdiction?
There is a putative class action claim.
I'm sorry, a what?
There is a putative class action claim.
If the plaintiff doesn't have standing, she can't pursue a class.
I agree with your honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Dmitrieva.
Thank you.
And Mr. Usharovich, do you have anything further?
Just briefly. The problem is here, and I understand with limiting the courts, or the gates of the courts, to allow people to bring Eighth Amendment challenges, but that can't, just the fact that the courts may get flooded with people filing tickets, there's filing fees. There's certain barriers that are put in place, and there's also ethics rules that govern good faith cases. But there needs to be a vehicle, in Illinois especially, to challenge the conduct of government, especially in these
days. They're the courts.
Right, but we don't have an Eighth Amendment excessive fines clause.
You have a challenge that just says the city's ordinance is invalid. I don't think it is, but you can at least make that argument in the Cook Circuit Court, right?
Correct, but not an Eighth Amendment argument.
So what?
What do you mean, so what? Well, let's forget about the Fourth Amendment. Let's forget about the Second Amendment. So what? I mean, these are the
point. Your only Eighth Amendment argument is that this violates state law.
No, right? The state, no, the fine has no basis for being assessed. If it's, even though it's a violation of state law, that's an independent claim that you can bring. What we're saying is when the government exacts a fine that is not authorized by law or prescribed within the limits by the General Assembly or the legislature, they've gone beyond the Eighth Amendment.
So if the state, if the city government violates state law, it has violated the Eighth Amendment.
If
right?
The city, no.
That's the logic.
No, that's not the logic. If the city violates a law dealing solely with their ability to set fines and unlawfully then takes money, they're violating the Eighth Amendment. And no court in this country, no court within, I mean, it's fundamental to our sense of ordered liberty and justice that the courts make sure that there is not a manifest injustice.
Mr. Yasharovich, you have convinced me that you are just barely over the layer, the level of a frivolous appeal. You're acting in good faith. And you've got an argument for modification of the law. You've gotten that far in oral argument with me. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Yasharovich and Ms. Dmitrieva. So.